Case 13-5207, Wilbert Harris, Appellant v. United States Department of Veteran Affairs. Mr. Temple for the appellant, Mr. Lawrence for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Donald Temple. I represent the appellant, Wilbert Harris, in a case where the lower court granted summary judgment to the defendant. We are here to ask this court to reverse that ruling, subject to a de novo review. And if the court would allow me to suspend with the facts, our primary reasons are multiple. Number one is the court's ruling below was premature. There are fact-intense issues regarding this particular incident, and I would direct
the argument is you never asked specifically for Rule 56F discovery.
We did not. We asserted in lieu thereof in the opposition to the motion that the motion was premature and that we did not have an opportunity, citing Tab versus the District of Columbia. And so in lieu of a Rule 56D affidavit, Rule 56F affidavit, we specifically advised the court that the ruling was premature. The ruling was made on the pleadings and on the basis of the exhibits which were provided substantially by the government, which were unto themselves contradictory and didn't show a factual basis for a matter of law ruling. So the second point, Your Honors, is—
Just to be clear from the record, though, there was an affidavit from Mr. Harris that was submitted.
That's correct.
In your opposition.
That's correct.
But you did not cite rule, I guess it used to be Rule 56F, it's now changed to Rule 56D.
That's correct.
You didn't cite that in your opposition.
We did not. Even notwithstanding that particular rule, even if you look at the record closely and you look at the exhibits which the defendant or the appellee provided and directed the court's attention to three documents. One is the offense report. In that offense report, what it states is that Mr. Harris attacked the officer, that he was aggressive, that he was combative, that he was violent, and that he attacked the officer. That precipitated the arrest. That has to be read in conjunction with a contradictory document, which is the actual citation, which was for quote-unquote disorderly conduct, that Mr. Harris was loud and boisterous. There is no charge for assault on a police officer. There is no charge for resisting arrest. There is no charge for disobeying an officer's order. So those two documents unto themselves are contradictory. The third document that I would ask the court to direct its attention to is the use of force investigation. In the use of force investigation at A59, they talk about an investigation. Notably, that use of force investigation is not authenticated or signed or dated, but it suggests that there was, quote unquote, an investigation to which we didn't have the opportunity, of course, to discover. Back to the police report, the offense report. In the offense report, what is significant is that it doesn't say that Mr. Harris was violent at all. What it says is that Mr. Harris, when he was asked by the officers to leave the room, he complied. That contradicts directly the affidavit of Mr. Sheets, the counselor in that particular class, who stated that Mr. Harris was violent, he had to be forced out of the room. The court, the lower court, essentially made credibility determinations against Mr. Harris. The lower court ruled on, in several respects, with this record, that Mr. Harris was combative, that he was violent, that he was arrested because he forcefully went back into the room. Mr. Harris, for the record, is a 40-year PS, post-traumatic stress disorder, Vietnam vet, who is being treated in a post-traumatic stress disorder counseling session. Mr. Harris's affidavit contradicts, in addition to the police own concession, that Mr. Harris was cooperative. What they state, though, is that Mr. Harris forced himself into the room. Mr. Harris at no point forced himself into the room. On the credibility issue, the lower court also found, and it states that there were no major injuries. In this record, in our submission, Mr. Harris has a fractured rib. The November the 6th document shows that he had a bruised rib. The November the 8th documents confirm the Veteran Administration's own medical records that he had a fractured rib. In addition to that, Mr. Harris testifies that his jacket was torn, his glasses were broken, and that at no point in this record is there scintilla of evidence that Mr. Harris used any profanity, that he was combative, that he struck anyone.
The district court relied upon a statement in the complaint, an allegation in the complaint, to find that there was no dispute of material fact as to the existence of probable cause, or at least the officer's reasonable belief that they had probable cause. And he relied on a statement in the complaint that said, I don't have the quote in front of me, but that Mr. Harris attempted to go back into the room. And so the court said that concession, so to speak, in the complaint was sufficient to establish probable cause to arrest for disorderly conduct because it was undisputed that he had been told he could not go back into the room.
Well, actually, that we addressed it in our brief. And in fact, the court miscites the actual complaint. The court refers to paragraph 12. It's actually paragraph 14. And Mr. Harris doesn't say that there was an order to not go back into the room. In fact, Mr. Harris states that there was never an order by the police. Rather, it was Mr. Sheets, the therapist, who stated that he could not go back into the room. Further, Mr. Harris states that he complied with that. He never disobeyed the police order. The police never stated, and that's not what the allegation states. It states not that he could not go back into the room, but that this gentleman stated that he could not go back into the therapy session. Mr. Harris's contention was, I came here for therapy. This all was triggered, as a matter of fact, behind Mr. Harris's notion that Obama was just elected president. Mr. Harris has stated consistently in his affidavit and in the record from the police, they never state, other than the fact that they say he was combative and loud and boisterous, those testimonies are contradictory to what Mr. Harris states. And the police statements are contradictory unto themselves. As to the issue of probable cause, the lower court, in response to your question, is actually misstating the record, and it's misstating what Mr. Harris stated here. Mr. Harris's testimony is definitively that the police officers never stated to him that he should not go back into the room. The only Mr. Harris, and the testimony is that, and has to be read in a particular context, because the testimony is that Mr. Harris forcibly went back into the room. And that is read in conjunction with the offense report where the police state, and it should be read in Mr. Harris's favor when you look at the police affidavits, which are all part of the record. They state that Mr. Harris came specifically towards a Lieutenant Nesbitt in a combatant striking form as if he was going to attack him. And in addition to that, that's point one. Point two is that Mr. Harris was combative with the other officers. What does that mean? Is Mr. Harris striking? Is he swinging? What is he doing? It suggests that he's out of control, that he's swinging at everyone. That has to be read in the problem factually on both counts in terms of the ruling being premature, and in a credibility account, is that it's suggesting that in the disorderly conduct citation, it only states that Mr. Harris was loud and boisterous. Of course, the court knows that Mr. Harris has to have committed a crime, a misdemeanor in the officer's presence, to justify an arrest. If Mr. Harris was going back into the room, and it's an issue of fact, was he going back into the room forcibly against their will? And the way that that's accentuated is by them writing affidavits 4 years later to suggest that Mr. Harris was going into the room forcibly and that he was combative. That's not what Mr. Harris testifies to. And so on the probable cause, we think that there's an issue, a genuine issue of fact, as to whether or not there is Mr. Harris is going to the room forcibly or not, whether he's even loud or boisterous. What's significant in this respect is that so early in this stage of the litigation, there's no opportunity. There was, as Mr. Sheets testifies and swears in his affidavit, there was another person teaching in the class. There's no affidavit from that person. There were other people in that class. There's no affidavit. There's no opportunity for us to depose anyone. Further, Mr. Sheets states that Mr. Harris's state of mind was psychotic.
File a motion under Rule 56, what is it, D?
D.
To allow discovery?
Well, no, we argued in our opposition that the motion was premature and that we had not had an opportunity to do discovery.
All right. The government argues essentially that Mr. Sheets had asked your client to leave the room. He left the room. Mr. Sheets called for the officers to come. And so the implication is that when your client was going back into the room, that was contrary to what Mr. Sheets had directed, and therefore the officers had probable cause to stop him when he attempted to go back into the room where Mr. Sheets was conducting the therapy session.
I guess the fundamental question there, Your Honor, is that if a man who has been in a post-traumatic stress disorder class and is there for treatment, and mind you, if he's going back in the room, whether he's going back forcefully or whether, as Mr. Harris submits, he's going back to retrieve his items, and he's no time combative, violent, loud, or boisterous, whether going back into that room and arguing on the defense side to disobey Mr. Sheets versus the police saying you cannot go back into the room, which is at issue, is whether that's a crime. And I submit to the court that it's not a crime. In fact, Mr. Harris asked, and it's on the record, he asked for his patient advocate. A man in that particular condition with an admittedly a 70% post-traumatic stress disability rating.
Your premise is that the security officials within this particular government agency can't remove somebody from a room after the person's been ordered to leave unless they're committing a crime.
I think removal...
There are regulations. The VA has regulations like, in my experience, other government agencies have, that if you have been ordered by an official within the agency to leave, you have to leave. If you don't do that, then the security officials are called upon to escort you out. Why does it have to be a criminal offense?
Well, because there's an arrest. And there's a difference between...
Yeah, it's an arrest. The person's restrained, that's for sure.
Well, not only was he restrained, he was handcuffed.
No, I'm talking about my hypothetical.
Oh, and your hypothetical. Well, first of all, I mean, I don't know those regulations because they're not admitted into this record. And so, assuming that they're...
One, it's 38 CFR 1.218A5. That's a VA regulation. Failure to leave premises when so ordered constitutes a disturbance.
And... But the disturbance is not criminal, and he did not fail to leave when so ordered. That's not in the record. Mr. Harris was not going into the class for his therapy. Mr. Harris was going to retreat. He was cooperating consistently, and the police state that. And so the fact that he was going into the room and to remove his articles is not a criminal offense. And Mr. Harris, and removal is one thing. The level of a response here was extreme. Mr. Harris was treated like a common criminal. He'd been coming to these classes for 40 years. And because he raises an issue of Obama won the election on November the 6th, it's not a disturbance. And if it is a disturbance, that's at issue itself.
Whose judgment is that?
Well, it's certainly in terms of the inference. I think the inference at that particular stage should be in plain.
Sheets tells the security officers he's creating a disturbance. What are they supposed to do? Have a evidentiary hearing before they take action?
Not at all. And I don't think that's the case. I think before they arrest him for disorderly conduct, there should be probable cause. And he can't arrest Mr. Sheets merely because the gentleman says that's not what happened. They did not arrest Mr. Harris on the basis of there being a disturbance in the class. They arrested Mr. Harris allegedly for what happened after Mr. Harris left the class, and for three different reasons, those factual predicates are conflicting. And so our position is that to the extent that they conflict, there are credibility issues that come into play. And so those credibility issues were basically, in this judge's opinion, they were made against the plaintiff. And then our view is that they should not have been made in the first place. I see my time is down to 1 minute.
All right, we'll give you a couple of minutes in rebuttal. Is that all right?
May it please the court, Craig Lawrence for the United States. I appear here in lieu of Ms. Johnson, who was involved in pretrial preparation in a separate case, and therefore I'm making the
happy to have you.
Thank you, ma'am. Now, obviously, the core of the case is undisputed material facts and where we go, and I think based on this record, the facts, the core facts are undisputed, and you can largely take most of them from the complaint. He entered, the plaintiff enters a group therapy session. He enters with...
Is there a dispute about whether or not there's a fractured rib?
There's no dispute that his rib was fractured. I believe that is reflected in the medical records. On the other hand, there is whether our point would be twofold. One, whether it's fractured or not is not material based on what happened in the arrest as he attempted to reenter.
So if he says in his affidavit that he was, you know, not resisting, but he was punched basically after he had been restrained in the rib and then his rib ends up being fractured, there's no material fact that would support an assault charge?
Well, it's undisputed that what happened at the when he attempted to reenter, that he was in the process of arrest, the plaintiff as well as the officers went to the floor. And in the government's view, that is sufficient, Judge Wilkins, to establish the probable cause because the attempted reentry and the effectuation...
No, but he's talking about a charge of aggravated assault here.
Well, he doesn't plead an aggravated assault claim in the complaint. He just pleads simple assault. He doesn't even specifically allege excessive force in the complaint. He alleges that the...
He alleges a common law assault, right?
Yeah.
This
assault
is all
and
common law.
Assault and battery.
Tort.
And in the context of an arrest, under the circumstances, it's undisputed that what was happening at that point was the arrest of the plaintiff. It's undisputed that what happened was they went to the floor and that he was subdued and then taken to the emergency
room. He says that he was punched. Shouldn't we take the record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't plead that he was punched in the complaint, and
what difference does that make?
Judgment.
He does. His declaration claims that he was punched and that he that broke his rib.
And the district court makes no reference to that whatsoever.
No, the district court did not, Your Honor. But under the circumstances, the key element here, in assessing an arrest in this context. Obviously, in Graham against Connor, the Supreme Court, and more recently this court in the Oberwetter case, reflect that these situations are to be analyzed in the context, not 2020, but in the context of what happened at the moment and the actions of the officers under the circumstances. And the circumstances here were that, at a minimum, Mr. Sheets had directed that the plaintiff leave the group therapy session. He specifically directed that he not return. That he attempted to return, and Joint Appendix 11 deals with the facts as related by as pleaded by the plaintiff. And he was standing right at the door. He attempted to return to the group therapy session, the room where the group therapy session was taking place, and it was at that point that the arrest took place. And there's no dispute that he was taken to the floor, and under those circumstances, with the immediacy of it, the fact that he was reentering a room where he had been specifically instructed not to return, and where the director of the therapy had called the officers to address that particular situation.
His testimony is that he was punched after he was not resisting. You know, he was on the floor, been taken to the floor, not resisting. He was punched, and the area where he was punched is where he ends up having a fractured rib. Why isn't it for the jury to decide whether, A, he was punched, and B, whether that punch was kind of justified under the common law standards that are applied for police in the the reasonable use of force standards. Why isn't that for a jury?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we've got to be careful that not to use subjective standards here, but on the basic point here and the government's point is that in light of the complaint, the he can't amend his complaint by filing a declaration.
So the complaint has to say, it can't just say excessive force was used. It has to detail chapter and verse.
It has to
everything
be
about the excessive force. Is well, that what Iqbal and Twombly requires?
You've got to plead sufficient facts. Now, I will admit that the question here is under those under the circumstances as pleaded in the complaint, and no effort to amend the complaint to include the additional facts that he pleads in his declaration.
What case
declaration.
Do we have, or anywhere, does it say that in opposing summary judgment, a plaintiff has to amend their complaint as opposed to a plaintiff just has to put in an affidavit that shows that there's disputed facts?
No, our point is not that he has to amend the complaint when he's opposing summary judgment, but if he's adding facts that are to be deemed material to his complaint. I mean, the district court assessed it.
So you have to plead every material fact in your complaint, not just enough to state a claim.
Well, the flip side of it is, in terms of assessing summary judgment and looking for disputes of material fact, where there is no claim of excessive force in the complaint.
Let me just back up a minute, so I get this straight. There's nothing in the complaint or amended complaint. And there's nothing in any of the medical reports that were done at the time to indicate that this gentleman had a fractured rib.
The fractured rib appears 2 or 3 days later on an examination, but it did not appear when he was immediately taken to the emergency room.
The emergency room, the first day, he says he's got sore ribs.
Right.
The very day of the incident.
But, well, I'm not sure that he was very explicit there. His claim is that what he failed, he didn't describe things because the police were present.
Can I just follow up on this, Judge?
Certainly.
Rogers, please. Your statement in the brief is not accurate, then. It says that only until a year later, after Appellee's motion for summary judgment, did appellant complain about rib pain.
No, that is inaccurate, Your Honor. I do understand that got into the brief, but no, it's within several days, but it's not on the day, and he explains it, I believe, in his declaration.
It was on the 6th, and he complained of the soreness. He comes back on the 8th, and they say
he's got
a fractured rib.
That's right. He's diagnosed at a later point with a fractured rib. Now, our point is simply that based on the record before the district court and the pleading and the complaint especially, that...
ignoring the opposition for summary judgment.
Not ignoring it.
Affidavit attached there, too?
No, not ignoring that declaration. And the declaration is consistent. It does add additional facts, but it also... our view is that under the undisputed facts are very narrow here, and we don't disagree. We understand that the broken rib and the punch were specifically alleged claimed by the plaintiff in his affidavit. We're resting on the narrower claims in the complaint and the framing of the request for relief. And the absence in there of a claim, A, of excessive force, and B, any claim about the broken rib.
But, counsel, he says he was assaulted. All right.
Well,
and now, when the government is moving for summary judgment, he opposes it on the grounds that he was assaulted in that, and he lists all of the things.
Well, Your Honor, the assault
way,
would...
That's a proper way to proceed under the rule, isn't it?
Yes, and we would say that under the circumstances, the assault that he claims is exactly what happened during the arrest, that He attempted to re-enter the room.
No, no. We understand your point about
and so
there is an area of undisputed fact, but of course his complaint is going to the area that is disputed. That's all I'm getting at.
No, no. His declaration does go beyond the complaint, and we understand that. But our point is on it whether you it would be characterized without probable cause that what the officers did was an assault on the plaintiff.
So is the government's position that once the police have probable cause to arrest you, any injuries that may have been suffered in effecting that arrest are necessarily non-tortious?
No, Your Honor, it's a very fluid kind of assessment under probable cause. The Supreme Court in Graham against Connor, and actually the Oberwetter case is somewhat analogous in the sense that the woman there who was dancing claimed the use of excessive force, and she was slammed, according to her, she was slammed into one of the columns in the Jefferson Memorial. And the court takes the Graham against Connor approach, obviously the correct approach in light of the Supreme Court's opinion, that we can't use 20/20 hindsight to assess the context.
I know, but Chief Justice Rehnquist and his whole approach on this is, would an objectively reasonable officer under the circumstances
have
acted reasonably in employing that force? And Mr. Harris is contesting that. He's saying he was assaulted. Well, that's all I'm getting
well,
at.
Well, our point is that in the context of what happened when he went to the floor during the arrest, that obviously at that point the officer's employment of force to restrain him from going back into the group therapy session where he'd been ordered not to return, they employed reasonable force to arrest him and prevent that.
I guess Mr. Harris's point is there's no allegation of assault on a police officer, and the disorderly conduct is he was loud and boisterous, and his position is he was saying, what are you doing to me? Why are you doing this? In any rate, I guess the point is at the stage where we're at summary judgment, doesn't the district court have to address the contested allegations to determine whether or not the government is entitled to judgment as a matter of law? That's all.
Exactly, Your Honor. We believe that although the district court may not have employed the undisputed facts, we believe that the undisputed facts on this record support summary judgment, and that obviously this court reviews that record de novo, and it becomes this court's determination. And our view would be that, well,
what's your argument for saying that excessive force was force that caused a fractured rib was not excessive?
Well, it's understandable in the context of being taken to the ground. Once in the context of the making the arrest, he hits the ground apparently on his chest.
We don't know. All right, that's
that is not absolutely clear, but it's certainly if they are obviously approaching him from behind because he's turning and entering the room at that point.
Although the counselor, I'm forgetting his name, says that he appears to be attacking Lieutenant Nesbitt. So if then that's when he's, you know, taken to the ground and arrested. So unless he's got an inventive way of attacking by, you know, backing into him, one would think that he was facing the officer when he was taken to the ground.
I don't believe that Lieutenant Nesbitt described an attack on
himself. Part of the problem here is that Mr. The counselor describes what predicates the arrest as Harris attacking the officers, and the officers say what predicates the arrest is that he attempted to forcefully enter the room. There's two different stories.
Well, but at a minimum, it is undisputed that he attempted to reenter, and it's undisputed that at that point the arrest occurred. And the interaction between the plaintiff and the VA police officers. There are obviously other elements here that are raised and on the table.
What's your position on the question that I asked you, Mr. Temple, that what are the police in a government agency, or not the police, the security officers in a government agency, supposed to do when an individual is causing disruption and is ordered to leave the room by whomever it is?
It is that they have the authority to do exactly as they did, and in fact, the undisputed facts in this record are that the police officers were complied with VA policies and procedures, and there's no...
They don't make... The security officers don't make a decision about whether there's a criminal offense or not, do they?
No.
I thought the procedure was that they go to the U.S. attorney.
That's right.
They take the individual to the U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney makes a decision about
That's what happened here. He was detained, cited for disorderly conduct. My understanding from the record is that he didn't show up for his hearing, but that the assistant U.S. attorney, I believe it was an assistant U.S. attorney. This may be a D.C. offense, I don't know, but whoever the...
This was in Washington.
Yes, it was. But the charge was then dismissed.
Yeah.
So that was not pursued. But Judge Randolph, I believe you were absolutely correct. Here the officers are responding to Mr. Sheets' request for assistance, the complaint about a disturbance in the group therapy session, and responding to that situation, that it is clear that the plaintiff left when directed to leave. It's also clear that he was ordered not to return, and that it was his attempt to return without asking to return. He simply turned and attempted to re-enter.
You say it's undisputed he was ordered not to return.
He pleads it in his complaint, Your Honor,
yes.
I believe.
And the question is, who ordered him?
I'm not sure the court specifically... The complaint specifically identifies it, but it's clear that at a minimum it was Mr. Sheets. I believe the complaint, and it would be joint appendix about 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there, that describes what the specific pleaded facts were in that respect.
All right.
You concede that this was an arrest?
Yes. Yes, it was an arrest. And we therefore ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Temple, let me assure you, the court is also happy to see you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
And likewise. Your Honor, if I may, the appellees have done something here which is inconsistent with the record. And the appellant's position is that he was not arrested because he went back into the room. And there is nothing on the record on November the 6th, 7th, or 8th that comports with that interpretation of the record. The November the 6th disorderly conduct citation doesn't state that he was locked up because he went back into the room. It says it because he was boisterous and loud. The offense report, which is critical.
That's the language of the provision that they were thinking about charging him with. But, you know, the law is that if you commit, or if there's probable cause to believe you've committed several different offenses, and the police stop somebody and arrest them, even if they arrest them for the wrong offense, they still have probable cause.
But
there's a case in this circuit called United States versus Prandy Benet, B-I-N-E-T-T. And if you look at the end of the opinion, that comports with the law of other circuits. And the example that's given is a burglar alarm goes off in the dead of night, and the police see somebody running right out the door of the store. Now, they don't know whether the guy committed burglary or attempted burglary or robbery or attempted robbery or illegal possession of a weapon. They don't have to make that judgment. If they arrest them, they have with probable cause, and in that situation they had probable cause.
Well, in the law in the District of Columbia says that a misdemeanor has to be committed in the presence of an officer, And in this particular situation, what the officers, what I'm suggesting to the court, is what the officers did. In the absence of having a actual misdemeanor, that there's a question as to whether their affidavits are truthful. The report states, and I direct the court's attention to the report where it states definitively, and this is contemporary.
The appendix is this one?
This is the appendix at S59, A59.
This is the sealed appendix.
No, the joint appendix.
What, could you give me that citation again?
Yeah, it's A59 of the joint appendix. It's the offense report. Excuse me, it's A53.
Yeah.
And this goes to the heart of what the appellant is arguing. They said they were trying to explain to him that why he had to leave the class. They said he refused to listen. And then they both attempted to explain to Harris the policy. And if he had a complaint, he had to go to the instructor. He refused to listen. Their story. Harris is told several times that he couldn't return. And then they say, and then went towards, and then they said that Harris, not that he attempts to go to the room, that Harris went to his counselor in an aggressive way, went towards Lieutenant Nesbitt in an aggressive way and got combated with the police officers. He was then taken to the ground and put into restraints. The point is that they arrested, it didn't happen as they suggest in their affidavits, which were prepared 4 years later.
You must be looking at the wrong page. Did you say A59?
53, I corrected it.
Oh.
Yes, I'm sorry.
So you're talking about maybe about 8 or 9 lines up from the bottom.
Correct.
The sentence that says, and then went towards Lieutenant Nesbitt.
Notably, this report, read in conjunction with the citation, are closer in time. Let me also state to the court as well, this isn't as narrow a case as the appellee suggests. The fractured rib, the court should note, at SA-19 of the health records appendix, that Harris complained about not being able to breathe at the point of being arrested. And it states in those medical records, the Veterans Administration medical records, he had a bruised rib on the 8th. Harris decided not to talk because the police wouldn't let him talk, and he came back on that same day. And then he came back 2 days later when he was diagnosed by the Veterans Administration with a fractured rib.
Yeah, what if he didn't have a fractured rib and the police didn't take him down, and they still, when he tried to go back into the room, they restrained him, and then following the VA policies that once you're ordered out of a room, you can't go back in because of this disturbance of the medical procedures that are going on in that room, and they took him to the U.S. attorney. Would that be a false arrest?
Oh, it's a big what if, and it depends.
Yeah, of course.
It depends on what Harris is doing.
And in that situation, it usually does depend.
Yes, and in that situation, on the assault and battery, there's not an assault and battery in that particular hypothetical. There's still the open question, I think.
You know, I left one fact out. I mean, that the director of who's doing the group therapy sessions, this tells the police this guy's coming in and he's creating a disturbance, and they escort him out, and then he tries to go back in. Forget about forcefully or anything else, and the police say, or not, these are not police, these are security officers, right?
Well, they,
and they take him and restrain him, escort him out the building to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Security officers in the District of Columbia who have arrest authorities are treated equivalent to police as a premise. And so if they have arrest authorities and it is an arrest, as the appellee concedes here, then there has to be probable cause. So we start with that.
Described as VA police.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
And so to that extent, what we are saying to the court is that there is not, there is an issue, a genuine issue of material fact as to the probable cause. The court is saying because he created a disturbance by going back into the room, I think Judge Randolph.
I'm just asking a question. If you know, what is the alternative for the security people in the building?
Well, let me ask. I think the question is answered this way. In a situation where there is a post-traumatic stress disorder scenario for Vietnam vets, nonetheless, and this guy's in treatment for 40 years, I think that arresting someone who has served the country because there's a disturbance.
What year did he begin his treatment?
Pardon?
What year did he begin his treatment?
40 years from 2008.
What is that, 1978? No.
1968. Yes.
PTSD was not a recognized psychiatric disorder in 1968. It first became recognized in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Volume 3, in the 1970s.
So, but that
he was treated, but he wasn't being treated for PTSD.
But even
I don't deny that. I don't question that. But
even a footnote from the police could see that as of 2002, he had 70% PTSD disability rating. Yeah. And the fact of the matter is that, to your question, I don't think that you call security and arrest someone because of what's perceived to be a disturbance about an Obama being elected president. I mean, I think that that's extreme. And more importantly, you should have probable cause to arrest someone. And the dichotomy here is that he's not arrested, and this is the issue of fact, he's not arrested because he was going back in that room. He's arrested for his behavior, and I would even submit to the court based upon the offense report, he's not even arrested because he's being allowed. That these guys, their judgment was, we have to detain this person for whatever reason. And you just can't detain someone because you don't like what they're saying.
Had the session started?
Sorry? The session had started, yes.
Okay.
With that, we would submit that there are genuine issues of material fact on all issues. And I would also point out to the court on the excessive, on the assault and battery, the lower court's ruling turned on the fact that there were minor injuries and no significant injuries. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.